Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, we're going to do a show here, so we have to be on our best behavior. Understand that, Dr. Chartok. Pay attention, please. Alan Chartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is here. Sir?
How do you do?
It's wonderful to see you. Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, is here.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, it's nice to be back.
It's great to see you. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union of Albany, New York, where this program originates, here on posh Central Avenue near the state capitol and all the commercial activity of our state capitol. It's a wonderful season. We're near the end of the year, and we thought we should start off a little bit by talking about the best and the worst media errors of 2013. This is compiled every year by Poynter Institute, journalism training program in Florida. They say the worst media error of 2013 was that 60 Minutes report in late October that called into question the official version of what went on in Benghazi. Unfortunately, of course, they relied upon fraudster.
A bad source.
And beyond that, the fact is the guy had a book that was being published by a sister company of CBS News and that wasn't disclosed. There were a whole lot of things that went wrong.
But here's what I think, Rexy. I want to send my students out to stand on the corner of State Street in front of the legislature and ask the following question. What was the CBS offense on the Benghazi story? And let's see if anybody has the slightest idea all these months later as to what that's all about. You know, we in the profession, and it's a profession under great criticism. I mean, there have been polls lately showing us at the bottom of the pond by the public what they think about us and all the rest of it. I think memory is short, and so we love to beat up on an offender who we can then say, see, we're better than they are.
You know, what's really interesting to me about all these errors is how egregious they are or how they made these errors, because the system we have in place would prevent these things from happening. They didn't do the basic fact-checking that they should have, and error after error that made this top list this year.
Absolutely. And I think it's good, Alan, that we take issue and that we spotlight these folks, because you're right, the public doesn't remember, but the fact that we inside journalism do. Even more, I mean, I think egregious is the second best, right? The New York Post cover that identified with a photograph guys supposedly suspects in the Boston bombing said bag men because they were carrying a bag. And in fact,
and they had the wrong guys.
The wrong guys, yeah.
And they're being sued, of course, properly.
Yeah.
Right, but I bet the New York Post still insists that wasn't an error. They'll still stand by that they ran that.
Right, absolutely.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, look, I mean, part of the reason that we're at the bottom of the dump in terms of popularity that journalists are is the New York Post. I mean, every week I say something about the Post, and every week Rex says, you know, but that's the Post. You know, and I say, well, it's all part of one perception about what journalism is. And, you know, it's too bad that, I mean, they do sell, I think, something like 700,000 papers every morning. That's a lot of papers.
It's a lot.
And then they say five people read every one of them, which is nonsense. Oh, they don't say that, but we hear that kind of thing.
But it's got to be disheartening to every other newspaper in the country that works so hard to maintain ethical standards, and they do, and we do. And day after day, we're making these very difficult decisions and trying to be as ethical as we can, and then somebody comes out and wipes it away.
Yeah. I love also the Poynter points out the best corrections of the year, and these are always fun. Here's one, for example, from the London Evening Standard referring to an art exhibit. The late Sebastian Horsley's suits at the Museum of London. By unfortunate error, we referred to Rachel Garley, the late Sebastian Horsley's girlfriend, who arranged the exhibition, as a prostitute. We accept that Ms. Garley is not and has never been a prostitute. We offer our sincere apologies to Ms. Garley for the damage to her reputation and the distress and embarrassment she has suffered as a result by unfortunate error. I love the way that they state these
things. Well, you know, my favorite is The Times. I'm a big fan of The Times, and I read it, you know, religiously. But I love their corrections because, you know, after Jason Blair and all that stuff, they started to do these corrections. They say, yes, the guy's name had two T's at the end. instead of one T, just showing how good they are. But Rex, back to your other point, I know that you were trying to be contentious with me and slap me down as usual. But, you know, I think there's a certain amount of schadenfreude here, you know, that when one of our colleagues makes a mistake, quite frequently there's somebody who says, who feels good in their kishkas about the whole thing.
Because it wasn't us.
That's one of the reasons I love reading corrections.
Do you?
Yeah. One of my favorites from this year was the a man referred to a Navy captain as thickset. The correction says he should have been described as muscular. As someone who takes these calls, I can imagine the conversation the editor had when the guy called up and said, hey, I'm that thickset. You know, my trainer will tell you I'm, you know, 40% muscle. I mean, but those are the kind of things.
Does it mean fat? Or what does it mean?
Thick set.
Apparently, this man thought it meant, you know, flabby, and obviously he's muscular. had to run a correction on this.
But Judy, I love the fact that you take the calls. Now, we all take calls. Oh, yeah. I take calls. Rex takes calls. You take calls. So here's the thing. Sometimes they're right. And sometimes you listen very carefully and say, mm-hmm. You know what? You're right. You know, this and that. We'll try to do a correction. The rest of it. Sometimes they're just really nuts. I mean, really crazy. And you know from almost the first minute you pick up the phone that you've got somebody on your hands who is really off the wall.
I got a guy on my voicemail every morning, one particular guy. his voice is recognizable. And I know that sometimes he calls me when I'm in my office. I'll pick up the phone because I'm there in the evening. Yeah. And what he'll do is he'll pretend that there's something wrong with the line. He'll poke the numbers on his phone. It's like, beep, 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 beep. And I know that's this guy.
But I get a lot of people who say that when I answer the phone that they don't want me. They just want my voicemail.
Right. I don't have to confront you. I just want to confront your recording.
Right.
So there was a discussion last week about police blotters. And we have somebody who was a reporter 40 years ago working as a radio news reporter in New York State and then went on to newspaper reporting talking about having a problem with the village police blotters and the state police blotter, saying this, with a police blotter, by the term, that is the record that is open that sits there in the police precinct or in the headquarters, gives out very little info, our writer Ken says, but it does allow you to ask for more. Whether you get more is another story sometimes. If an arrest was made, there was a way to get around any police reluctance to share more details by going to the local town or village court. And that sometimes will work, you know. You have this issue, don't you, in Schenectady as well?
Right, and we call them the incident reports. When the police respond to any kind of call, they file an incident report, and the incident report gives you the depth of what's happened. We can, you know, there was a body found in a place. Well, you have to ask for the incident report to find out more information. We would like the incident reports to be available all the time, but at this point, with the Schenectady Police Department, we have to file a Freedom of Information request, which takes time. They maintain that they don't want to release them because it contains certain privacy information or information that would hinder the prosecution or the investigation of the criminal case. So they don't want to release it, but as a result, we don't get a lot of information. There was an incident at the movie theater in downtown Schenectady, and getting that incident report, we didn't get that incident report at the time, and that's one of the reasons the story wasn't fully developed back in June when it happened.
Yeah. So why do you think they don't want to give it to you? I mean, you've given us what they say, but you think they're just CYA covering their behinds?
I mean, when I started covering cops, I always read incident reports. I read them all the time. I didn't publish the witnesses' names or their phone numbers, but I used it as background often to write a full story about the incident. It may be that they are trying to cover themselves.
Their behinds, cover their fronts,
right,
or backs,
as you would say. But also, they say that it's just too much work for them to do. I can understand that, but the public really has a right to know what's happening. Often, we won't find out about an incident until an arrest is made. Well, we want to know before that happens. If there's a rash of burglars, we want to know. We want to know as much.
Have you gone to the mayor and all and said, you know, can you get these guys in line? I mean, what's happening?
We've gone to the police chief and the commissioner of public safety about it, and they say it's not going to happen.
We're not not going to give it to you.
You know, and when police refuse to release stuff, what this leads to is you end up just depending entirely upon their goodwill, wanting to talk to you. We had an incident recently in Saratoga Springs, just north of where we're sitting, where a homeless woman died on a very, very cold night on a Thursday night, and I don't think we knew about it until a Monday.
And it was in the blotter. The Saratoga Springs Police Department is very good about emailing us their blotter every day, but it just had an unintended death. We have unintended deaths quite frequently. Didn't say it was out in the open, didn't say it was a homeless person, so there was really no way of knowing that this was a story we needed to follow unless someone in the department said, hey, this is an important story.
When I was a young reporter, I sat next to one of these grizzled old prototypical cops reporters. He'd say, and hour after hour, every hour, he would make a string of checks of the seven police precincts that he covered. And I would hear him say, hey, Sergeant Jimmy O'Neill here. How you doing? Anything going on? Okay, thanks. And so the desk sergeant would talk to him. Now, he would go around, and this sounds like just too much of a stereotype, but he would go around with boxes of donuts to these precincts and drop off.
Called bribery.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, you need their cooperation, obviously. And if you get in their faces, they just get angrier, and then they take it out on you. But the public has a right to know. I know that a lot of the newspapers that I look at almost always have police reports. I think one of the two tabs in New York has a police report every day. People run to it and look at it, you know, and see whether it's somebody they know or some place that they go. And I mean, I understand, but I think there may be a correlation between police misbehavior and their inability to let you see what they're doing. I think the Albany Police Department has become more open under its progressive administration and is a pretty good department that way. And I think it's a pretty clean department.
More so now, certainly so. But, you know, this is all part of a trend that is reflected in a lot of government where we are much more now subservient, basically dependent upon the flacks to give us information. Areas where reporters used to be able to go to get information are now cut off as a result of security imposed post 9/11. Government agencies from the White House down have much more focused all of their energies on public information officers. I was thinking of this when I read about the appointment of a longtime Albany hand, Dean Fulahan, to be the director of budget for the city of New York under the new mayor, Bill de Blasio. Fulahan was a young staffer on the Assembly Ways and Means Committee when I first came to Albany as a young reporter in the late 80s, and I would go up and hang out in his office on the fourth floor of the Capitol. No other reporters would go to the fourth floor of the Capitol.
But well, it's pretty high up there.
But you could go up and find out what's going on with fiscal staffers. And now, you know, everything goes through press aides, press agency spokespeople.
And well, we know, Rex, from firsthand experience, that there have been, in the Pataki administration, for example, there was a controller of public information known Xenia Muka. And I tell you, the fastest way that I think somebody could have gotten into trouble is done anything on their own without running it through what we call the second floor or the governor's office. There is control of information. Information is power because, you know, politics is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources.
The authoritative allocation of scarce resources, you say.
That's right. And information, as you know, is a scarce resource.
And especially concerning now is this new generation of reporters. This is all they've known. They
yes.
have never had the opportunity to go into an office and talk to the actual person who did the investigation.
Sure.
Of a certain report. And so they don't know anything different. They hear these stories from us older editors that this is how this dreamland where it used to happen very, very nicely. But they have come to accept this and they just use those flax sources and just wait.
Mm-hmm. And it gets even more complicated because sometimes they find somebody who's willing to spill, you know, off the record. And then we start seeing them being subpoenaed and people asking them where they got the information. And I tell you, even the president of the United States has been pretty bad on this issue.
Oh, yes. There was a meeting last week of press entities, the American Society of News Editors, the press photographers and so on, with Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, objecting to something we talked about a couple of weeks ago in this program, which is the intensity of turning out photographs taken by the White House photographer as opposed to letting press photographers shoot stuff.
Yeah.
This is unprecedented the way that the Obama administration has restricted photographers' access to the president. There's a group in Washington trying to stop this, turn back the tide of public affairs officers. They call themselves the Stop the New American Censorship. It's an interesting group of reporters trying to turn things around. So we'll see.
That's called SNAC.
Well, and bravo to them. And one of the things we're seeing is it does happen at the federal level. It does happen to the state level. And now we're slowly seeing it happen at the local level.
That's right.
Cities, towns, villages are starting to do the same thing. And
so it goes along with a lot of the other things that we're reading about in the newspapers every day. The National Security Agency keeping tabs on our phone calls and everything else. When you add it all up, what do you got? You got, as they said in Cinderella, bippity boppity boom. I mean, you're getting more and more government control over information and everything else. And the citizenry doesn't know what they're not getting, which is why, you know, with the WikiLeaks and everything else, there's been a fierce debate as to whether these releasers are heroes or traitors.
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah, we just had the poll of what the top news stories of 2013 were. You know, editors are asked by the Associated Press to rate this. And my vote went for the leaks to Glenn Greenwald, the Edgar Snowden leaks, as being the top story of the year. I think that what he did in leaking, while a lot of people consider it to be offensive, it certainly was a significant step for journalism.
Well, I have always believed, and I've said it 1,000 times, you can't have a democracy unless people know what's going on. I mean, how can anybody walk into a voting booth and cast an intelligent vote if you don't know what the CIA and everybody else is up to? So here comes Snowden. I don't know that he had any great, I mean, nobody was bribing him or the rest of it that we know about. He walks in, he gives out all of this information, and the whole national security debate is because of what he did.
Yes.
And now we have the White House pulling back and saying, oh, well, we have to make some changes here. None of that would have been done if Snowden hadn't done the leak.
Right. Mm-hmm. This is information we should have known.
Yeah.
Yep. And it doesn't just happen in important public affairs. Actually, in terms of access to information, sports has changed, too. You know, you talk to old sports writers, even from just 20 years ago, they could go to the locker rooms and talk to these top stars. Now, you can't get access to A-Rod unless you're like in a very controlled environment. You can't talk to the great stars. And one of the interesting articles that I read over the past week was from the wonderful Boston Globe sports columnist Dan Shaughnessy, saying, you know, people expect us to be rooters for the teams that we cover. And he said, we're not. We're just looking for a good story.
I read that piece. You sent it around. I actually read it extraordinarily because it violated my law that anybody could prepare. But I thought there was, I mean, I think some of these guys are expected basically to be slanted in favor of the hometown teams, and that there are some who don't. But, you know, my reading of the sports pages indicates, I think, that, you know, that's nonsense.
People expect it, though. We have a sports columnist, Jennifer Gish, who wrote a piece a couple of years
that's
ago.
Jennifer Gish, G-I-S-H.
Uh-huh. Yep. Wonderful. She's our features editor and writes a weekly sports column as well. And she wrote a piece telling Buffalo Bills fans, hey, get over yourselves. Your team is not as great as you think it is. And wow, people erupted. You know, a sports columnist is supposed to express opinions. And she was basically telling them, your team isn't so great. Good. It's kind of in the realm of, and man, did people, and what's unfortunate is they came after her as a woman, too. There were an awful lot of people who said, or were denigrating her, because they said, well, you're a woman, what could you possibly know about this?
I'm interested in the sociological approach to why we pay so much attention to sports in this country. I mean, we know what A-Rod is all about because we read a lot about him. But we don't know a lot about some of the more sophisticated issues in politics or in economics because they're just too remote and too hard. So I think the fact that we know so much about sports and we react the way that we do to somebody, you know, dissing one of our favorites indicates that we have a real problem here because, as Marie Antoinette once said, let them eat cake. Or didn't say, depending on who you
are. And sometimes I think people who follow politics are following it much like they follow sports.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The politics is the sports of it. But, you know, the issue of whether sports writers favor the teams they cover is an interesting one. I think they have a hard time restraining themselves, but they really should be very objective. But they do, I think, in their heart, root for the team to make the playoffs, root for the team to win the Super Bowl.
Well, sure, it's better for them.
It is.
I mean, moisture, yeah.
If they make the playoffs, you know, they get worldwide exposure. Somebody puts a microphone in front of their face and says, what do you think of this?
It is interesting. The amount of attention that we do give to sports. The other night, David Allen Miller, the director of the Albany Symphony Orchestra, said to me, I realized sarcastically after he said it, he said, you know, I really want to thank you for your daily arts section, but I think you should cover sports too.
That's funny. And here's the editor who has to pull their finger up in the wind and say, now let's just see.
Let's just count the people.
Which people will want a better, more coverage of, and we all love David Alan Miller, but I mean, and it's his job to sort of tweak you and all the rest of it, but silliness is silliness.
Though it is probably true that more people attend Albany Symphony Orchestra concerts than go to, say, high school girls field hockey, yet we give a lot of ink to these minor sports in high schools. We pay a lot of attention to some of those, even though there's a very limited fan base, I think. No offense to the
field
hockey players.
Except that there are mothers of the people who will call you up and yell
at you. If you're just joining us, it's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, CEO of Judy Patrick, the editor of the Daily Gazette, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. You can join the conversation by sending us mail, media@wamc.org, and we invite you to do that, media@wamc.org. Very good thing. We should talk about cable news, because while Fox News remained the ratings champ in 2013, there was quite an amazing event the other day when Megyn Kelly, a Fox News anchor who comes from New York's Capital Region, as a matter of fact, she grew up here, asserted that Santa is white. She was reacting to an essay putting forward a black Santa, right? And she asserted that Santa Claus is white. And of course, this got a lot of humorous response, but it actually raised a question of whether she was perhaps just trying to project herself as an angry right-wing host rather than a straightforward news host, which some had thought she might end up being able to be. It suggests that she will probably have a hard time making a transition to a channel other than Fox News after this.
What do you think, Judy?
Well, let's note that her ratings are very high, as of all Fox's news ratings, very high. You know, just for the Media Project, I went and listened to this Megyn Kelly clip. And
that was preparation.
We've been talking about this for a week, or it's been buzzed about for a while, so I said I might as well listen to this thing. And sure enough, she was pretty out there and very, she's trying to stir up the issues, and this is why Fox is
not
successful.
Not only Fox, but MSNBC does the same thing on the left. You know, you have people.
Moved that way, though, years after Fox moved to the right.
Well, right, and I think because they saw they were successful.
Well, they saw that there was a niche that wasn't being served. I think Fox, though, nichified the, if there is such a word, the television spectrum, because there was, you know, we all sought to be, we tried really hard to be straightforward truth tellers. And Fox comes along with an intentional bias, and it was created intentionally to focus a conservative take on the news.
But the chutzpah in the situation is they give themselves, you know, a name which is fair and balanced, which it is anything but. So not only are we going to stick it in your eye and give you this right-wing perspective, but we're going to tell you, and you have to eat it, that we're fair and balanced.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The other issue is it's anything but news. It's really not news. This is
what
not
do you think
the news
it is?
It's entertainment. It's a show meant to generate income.
As a feminist,
well.
As a feminist, you are, I think, you're a true feminist. You early on got to be one of the top editors in New York State and all of the rest of it. That's my kind of feminism, I'll tell you the truth. You broke the glass ceiling. You did all of that stuff. Are you offended by the way they dress these women on Fox?
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, I am offended by how a lot of networks dress women. Why do women have to be sleeveless and in dresses, and men get to wear suits and ties?
Exactly.
Why are only good looking women broadcasting? That's the nature of broadcasting. Thank goodness, you know, I'm in newspapers, because I mean, I would have been retired a long, long time ago, because you have to be pretty and young and oftentimes blonde to do well in broadcast television.
Well,
who knows what I was?
She actually was a redhead, but
I'm very gray now.
Aren't we all?
But you're also pretty. So therefore, wait, I'm not done yet. So therefore, how do you know that didn't help
That's
you
right.
with your
there
bosses?
That's right. There you go. It doesn't have anything to do with your skills. All right.
I didn't say that.
You know, I'm speechless.
Well, at that point, we have to go.
What?
Because
already?
We're out of time. Isn't it amazing?
Oh, this program ought to be an hour.
See you next week.
Politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy. It's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people, it's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery, She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people.